Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, honourable members. This morning procedures, we've got the apology of the chairperson who's attending a nuclear conference in Sandton. He indicated so last week. He had discussions with the WIP and asked that she chairs this morning's session. So if there is no objections to that, I will call Ma'am Dunjua to take the chair, sir.
So move.
I second.
So I think for the session is Madam Dunjua.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Sana Plaiki, member of the Portfolio Committee for Science and Technology. Thanks.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Janita Kloppers-Lodens, also a member of the Portfolio Committee. Jimena Mbakhaisen, Kipopi Muchumi, Ilokula Komiti, Soko Province, Gauteng, Korotinenya, Swane Ekgolo. Ke tlile go kopa gore ga re fitlha ko ureng ya lesome le bongwe ke lokollwe. Ke na le lebaka le leng go le lebelela. Ke a leboga.
Morning, everybody. I am Zintle Tlali, member of this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Romila Maharaj from the National Research Foundation.
Morning, I'm Petiwe Matutu from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Thomas Oftahida. I'm Deputy Director General for Human Capital and Knowledge Systems in the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Leander France, Parliamentary Liaison Officer, DST.
Good morning. I'm Michelle O'Connor from Media 24.
Good morning, my name is Elias Periska from PMG.
Good morning, Honorable Acting Chair and members. I'm Martin Mulcahy, Advisor to the Minister of Science and Technology.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honorable Members. My name is Aziza Fredericks and I'm the CSIR Parliamentary Officer.
Good morning, Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Mava. I'm from Parliamentary Communication Services.
Sipla Mahlabela, Committee Assistant.
Thank you. Without wasting any time, we will then hand over to the department to take us through its presentation in the order of session. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Acting Chair. As we all know, old furniture is usually made of much better wood than new furniture, isn't it? thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you and the Honorable Members a bit of an overview of the Department's activities in the area of human capital development, and allow me to emphasize that our department is responsible really only for high-level human capital development. In other words, postgraduate students and researchers. This is a brief outline of the presentation that I'll be presenting here. I'd first of all like to talk a little bit about the human capital development landscape at a policy level and at an institutional level. Then I'd like to highlight some high-level human capital development challenges to the members. And we will then outline a series of interventions that the department has initiated. We will be presenting the school-level interventions in a separate presentation later on. It's a secondary to the main presentation, which are we doing here. Then we'll be looking at new generation researchers, emerging researchers, and established researchers. These are three different categories of researchers that I will outline later on. And we thought it might be interesting for the members to also have a bit of an overview of our internship program. It's not strictly part of our human capital development intervention, but it's strongly related to that, and it might be very interesting for the members to see what we're doing there. And then lastly, just highlight a few areas of policy development. Turning first of all to the human capital development landscape, the institutional context. I've just outlined here the three key departments that are involved in human capital development. And the purpose, honorable members, of the slide really is to put the department's activities in the area of human capital into a context, into its broader context. First of all, the Department of Basic Education, as you know, is responsible for all basic education. Its budget is over 130 billion rand, which includes, of course, the funds that go to the provinces. There are 26,000 schools, 12.5 million learners. And if you take the number of learners and you multiply it by an average of about 5 hours per day that they spend in school, and you multiply it by about 200 school days a year, that works out to what I've written there as 12.5 billion learner hours per annum. That's how much teaching goes on or learning goes on in the schools. And I'll explain just now why I calculated that number for you. Then the Department of Higher Education and Training, which of course is responsible for higher education, both further as well as university, further education and training as well as the university sector. For the university sector, the budget is over 21 billion rand. There are 23 public universities and about 1 million students enrolled in them. Now let's turn to the Department of Science and Technology, which is principally responsible for research, development, and support and innovation across the national system of innovation. Our budget is 4.5 billion. It's a fraction of the budgets of the other departments involved in human capital development. We support about 7,000 students only out of the large number enrolled in the universities. And if we take the number of schoolgoers that we have an interface with, mainly in the National Science Week, and my colleague Dr. Matutu will be talking about this later on. If we take that and we multiply it by the number of hours that we interface with those schoolgoers and the number of days, it works out to 1.5 million learner hours per annum, which is 1% of the 12.5 billion learner hours per annum. In other words, we have an engagement with 1% of the time that the school kids spend in school. The purpose of this point is to emphasize that it's the department's responsibility to look at the high-level human capital, the postgraduate students. We don't have the resources or the interface with the schools to be able to do anything that has a level, an impact on the system. It's not our mandate, and we don't have the resources or the interface because we have an engagement with 18 dinner lady schools. So this is the context within which the department is operating. Very briefly now, to look at the policy frameworks that guide us. Members will be familiar with the National Research and Development Strategy, which was approved by Cabinet in 2002. This emphasizes the need for human capital development, for investment in science and technology infrastructure as an input into human capital development. It emphasizes knowledge generation both for its own sake and also as an input into human capital development and an outcome also of human capital development. It emphasizes this question of strategic management of the public science and technology system because of the interface between the Department of Science and Technology and the university sector. There needs to be a coordination that happens at the level of the national system of innovation. And then it proposed the establishment of centers and networks of excellence, and you'll hear more about that later on. The second policy document that the members will be familiar with is the 10-year innovation plan of the Department of Science and Technology. And then lastly, at a higher level, within the medium-term strategic framework and the presidential monitoring and evaluation framework, there is outcome 5, which is focused on skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path, the development of such a skilled and capable workforce. Within that outcome, there are 4 outputs which the department has some level of responsibility to contribute towards. I don't need to go into the detail. This is just the framework against which the department is operating. So turning now to the high-level human capital development challenges. First of all, there are what we call low progression ratios. In other words, students going from a bachelor's or a first degree to an honors degree to a master's and to a doctoral degree. That progression ratio is very low, and I'll illustrate that by means of this table shortly. And secondly, there is a significant demographic drop-off as you go from an honors to a master's to a doctoral degree. So first of all, just talking about the progression ratios, if you look at these numbers, in these 2 rows here, you'll see that there are about 440,000 students enrolled in first degrees within the university sector. About 61,000 of those graduate in any 1 year. That is just the number of graduates from the 3-year degree programs. This number here includes students from 4-year degree programs like engineering and so on. We haven't included the numbers of graduates here in this amount. But you can see that we have this number of undergraduate students and only that number of honors students. In other words, students who choose to move from a first degree to a second degree. There's a significant drop-off. You can see it's roughly one-eighth of that number there. And then progressing from honors to masters, there's some drop-off. But more importantly, if you take it from honors through to the PhD, only one-fifth, there's roughly one-fifth as many doctoral students enrolled as there are honors students. And if you look at the number of graduates, the problem is even worse. So we have a significant complement of undergraduate students who could enroll for postgraduate studies, but for a range of different reasons, they are not able to or they choose not to. And this is what I mean by a low progression ratio. There's very few students who move through the system from the first year right through to the doctoral qualification. The demographic drop-off that we're talking about here is, if you look at the number, if we just look at the demographics in terms of black South Africans, you'll see that at the level of honors, 79% of the students are black. At the level of the master's, only 65%, and the level of the PhD, only 58%. So the demographics shift as you move from the honors to the master's to the PhD, and they become worse, obviously, as you can see. With the number of females enrolled, women enrolled, you'll see that, again, the same trend obtains. A higher percentage of the honors students are female, dropping to masters, dropping further to doctorates. And this demographic drop-off is a significant problem for the sustainability of the research community going into the future. Thirdly, there are very high attrition rates. A study has been made, for example, of the 2001 PhD cohort. And of the students who registered in 2001 for the first year of their doctorate, 46% of them, by the end of, I think it was last year or middle of last year, had not completed their degree. So 10 years afterwards, nearly half had not completed their degree. Secondly, nearly a third, 29%, of the students who registered for their PhD in that year dropped out in the first 2 years. Nearly a third of the students dropped out in the first 2 years of their PhD. The dropout rates are different in different sciences. In the natural sciences, the dropout rate is lower than it is in the humanities, for reasons that one can speculate about, but which we haven't investigated. But the point is, this is a very high attrition rate. We can't afford to have a situation where half of the PhD students, almost half the PhD students that enroll, never graduate or don't graduate after 10 years. This is a significant investment we're making, and we have to make sure that they do actually graduate. And then lastly, another important challenge is the low bursary values that we are able to afford. The average value of a National Research Foundation bursary to honors, masters, and doctoral students and postdoctoral students in this financial year, in the last financial year, was roughly 30,000, 40,000, 63,000, and 127,000. If you were to think of... Yes.
You said the value is per person.
Per person, yes. That's per person, yes, rands. So 30,000 rand per student, per honor student, that is supported through the National Research Foundation. And 40,000 for master students who receive bursaries from the National Research Foundation.
That's only for tuition. Sorry.
That's just a bursary. What they use it for is up to them. It's just a bursary. It's the level of support that we provide to the average student. There are higher values. There are some students who get higher values, and there are some that get lower values. But this is the average value. Now, if you consider...
I would request humbly to members that let's not interject the presentation. Yeah, okay. No, that's fine.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. If you think about an honors student who has finished his or her first degree, and they're faced with a choice. Do they enroll for an honors degree, or do they pursue a career? The after-tax salary that the average graduate might earn, after-tax salary, would probably be in the order of 100,000 rand, roughly, give or take 20. The same approximation can be made for somebody who's finished an honors degree and is faced with the choice of doing a master's degree or going out and starting a career, and they might earn after tax about $140,000. So if you compare these average bursary values with the after-tax starting salary, you can begin to see one of the reasons, possibly, why some students, even if they wanted to, could not afford to enroll for postgraduate students. Because you need to bear in mind that the vast majority of our graduates are, in fact, from poor backgrounds. They're not middle class. Many of them are middle class, but the majority are not middle class students. And so when they're faced with these choices, you understand the difficulty of choosing to enroll for a postgraduate degree. Then a fifth problem is that there is a comparatively low enrollment in engineering and natural sciences. At the honors level, only 14% of students are enrolled in engineering and natural sciences. At the master's and doctoral levels, it's considerably higher. Now, why do we say this is a challenge? It's a challenge because the converse of this is that more than half of our students at master's and doctoral levels are not enrolled in areas that are directly connected to socioeconomic development: engineering, natural sciences, physical sciences, biological sciences. They're enrolled in important areas of study, yes, but their contribution to the economic development of the country is probably going to be more marginal than that of students who would be enrolled in engineering, natural, and physical sciences. This is not to devalue the sciences, but it's simply an economic consideration. And then lastly, we have a very low PhD graduation rate by comparison to other emerging economies in the world. We produce less than 30 PhD graduates per million of population per annum. Developed countries and even many of the emerging economies produce 3 to 5 times that amount of PhD graduates per million population per annum. So the rate at which we're producing PhDs is extremely low as well. Three more challenges. Very few university staff are actually qualified to lead research. Only just over 35% of academic staff have PhDs. And really, strictly speaking, if you don't have a PhD yourself, you can't really train PhD students. It does happen in many cases, but technically it's complex for that to happen. Within the research councils, this percentage of the number of staff with PhDs is even lower. We haven't been able to do the research yet to establish exactly what it is, but it certainly is less than 30%. And then lastly, the national scientific productivity is average. Our researchers are very good at what they do. So their per capita productivity is higher than the global average. But as a nation, we have too few researchers. We produce only as much research as the size of our population would suggest. So we produce about 0.6 to 0.7 of the global scientific output, and our population is about 0.6 to 0.7 of global population. So we're not producing more people, more output than the size of our population would determine. And we need to be doing that. And that's because our science system is too small, relatively speaking. What are some of the strategic responses within the area of human capital development? First of all, we've developed a human capital development framework that separates out what we call next generation researchers, that's essentially students, from emerging researchers. These are people who are employed already in the system, but who are still doing PhDs or who have just obtained PhDs. And lastly, established researchers who are, as the word implies, established. They're well into their career as researchers. Within this first group of next generation researchers, we have established a series of postgraduate bursaries and work readiness programs, which you'll hear about later on. Within the emerging researchers category, we've established several postdoctoral fellowship programs and a program called Tutuka that specifically focuses on university employees who are enrolled for PhD degrees or who have just completed PhD degrees. And then within the established researchers category, we have a South African Research Shares Initiative and the Centers of Excellence, for example. This is just briefly an outline of the DST and National Research Foundation instruments. The National Research Foundation, as you know, is the agency on behalf of the department, and it manages these programs On behalf of the Department of Science and Technology, I've spoken already about the South African Research Chairs, the Centers of Excellence, postdoctoral fellowships, professional development, research professional development, internships, bursaries, and the international programs. So first of all, turning now to unpack the key activities that the department is engaged in these three different categories of researchers: the next generation researchers, the emerging researchers, and the established researchers. The main thrust in this next generation researchers, the main thrust is to improve the level of support for honors, masters, and doctoral students. I've already indicated to you that the per capita bursaries that we can afford to provide to these students is extremely low. What we did on a pilot basis in 2007, we introduced a special honors bursary, which was at that point called an innovation bursary. It was a bursary at a fairly high level that we introduced at the time when the department was not, in fact, providing many bursaries to honors students, because previously the department supported only masters and doctoral students. But in 2006 or 2007, thereabouts, the department took a decision to also start providing support to the honors students, and it did that in the form of this innovation bursary. And what we can see from those high levels of funding that we provided on a pilot basis to those honors students is that the retention rates in going from an honors degree to a master's and a PhD, those retention rates are very high, as you can see, honorable members, on this graph here. Let me explain this graph. I explained to you that this bursary scheme we introduced in 2007. We funded in 2007 270 honors students with these special bursaries. In 2008, we funded 268. In 2009, 286. And then 462 and 417. So it was ramped up here. So this is one group of students. This is another group of students. This is another group of students. If you look in the second year after we introduced the program, of this first group of students, the 270 that we were funding, some 33 had enrolled for a master's degree. None had yet enrolled for a PhD degree. This column here indicates the total number of master's and PhD students, so you'll see here some PhD students coming through. So in the next year, of the 270, 33 had enrolled for a master's degree the following year. The following year, some number, roughly 70, had enrolled for a master's degree, 120 had enrolled for a master's degree, and about 90 had enrolled for PhD degrees, with the total coming to 218. So of the two groups of students, that one and that one, whom we had supported, by the third year of this program, 218 had enrolled for either a master's or a PhD degree. By the fourth year of this program, 502 students of that group, and of that group, 502 students had enrolled for a master's and or a PhD program. So we had supported, by the fourth year of this program, we had supported roughly 800 students or so. Of those 800 students, 500 had registered for master's and PhD programs. That's a significant number. That's a significant improvement on the attrition rate I outlined to you early on. So we have here anecdotal evidence that higher values of bursaries enable students to enroll for and consider postgraduate degrees. This, honorable members, is an outline of the percentage of the total number of students enrolled in honors, masters, and doctoral degrees that is supported by the National Research Foundation through funds from the Department of Science and Technology. So you'll see in 2011, in the last year, only 3% of all honors students were supported by bursaries through the National Research Foundation. That's all we could afford to provide funding for. 7.5%, roughly, of master's students received bursaries, and just under 16% of the doctoral students who are enrolled in the universities receive bursaries from the National Research Foundation. That's an average of 8.8%. This is the number of students in total, honors, masters and doctoral students. This is the number of students, 7,500 roughly, that we're able to afford, and the cost of that is 260 million rand in that year. Now, I showed you earlier on a slide illustrating that if we wanted to make our bursaries competitive, we would need to treble the value of the bursaries. There was a 40,000 by comparison to 100, 60 by comparison to 140, etc. So we would roughly have to treble it. So if we wanted to keep the number of students the same, without changing the numbers, just making the bursaries competitive with the salaries, we would have to treble that number. So that would be about 800 million, just under 800 million, just increasing the value of the bursaries. If we wanted to increase the number of students as well, if we wanted to double this, it would still be a very small percentage that we would end up supporting, on average maybe 16% of the total number of postgraduate students. But the cost would jump from 800 million to 1.5 billion per year. So it's a significant increase. So this is the main problem that we're dealing with. All right. So what we are doing, though, is we're trying to ramp this up. We have been increasing the bursary values, and we're channeling more funds into our bursary programs because this is the challenge that we've identified. So we're increasing the per capita values. We've already started doing that, and we're starting to increase the number of students that we can support. But if we wanted to really have a big impact on the system, we would need significant new amounts of funding to do that. We are starting to capture students at honors level by providing bursaries. I showed you the efficiency with which our bursary program is beginning to pay dividends. We're expanding support for postdoctoral students because these are effectively R&D apprenticeships. People who have done a PhD and then do a postdoctoral fellowship, they get trained on how to become real researchers. They start supervising master students. So it's kind of an apprenticeship for a researcher. You can think of it that way. We need to prioritize financial need because the majority of our undergraduates who graduate are from poor backgrounds. And if we want to draw them into our postgraduate programs, we have to provide financial support to them. We need more black South African students to enroll for postgraduate studies, and we need more women to enroll for postgraduate studies. And we need to encourage young full-time students below the age of 40. A significant number of the PhD students in the university system are university staff members who are no longer young. And we need to shift that demographic as well. And then we need to prioritize natural, physical, and engineering sciences, and there are some vulnerable disciplines that need to be promoted as well. In the emerging researchers, the main focus is on recently graduated PhDs, staff members of universities, and postdoctoral fellows. That's what we're trying to focus on strongly there. We need to improve the staff qualifications. As I've already mentioned, 35% of academic and research staff in universities have PhDs. That needs to be significantly increased. Now, it's not something we can do on our own. The universities and the Department of Higher Education really are the main drivers in this, but we have some programs to support those initiatives, and these are very important. This is a very important intervention. We are trying to increase the number of postdocs. The number that we're currently supporting the last 2 years is over 400, 450 in 2010 and 404 in 2011, and we're focusing strongly on international cooperation, especially on trying to bring postdoctoral fellows into the country, because we don't have enough doctoral graduates to have a large number of postdoctoral apprentices in the country. The Tutuka program is our flagship program in this area, supporting, as I've indicated, doctoral students who are enrolled, who are employed as staff members in universities while doing PhDs, as well as university employees who have recently graduated. The number of individuals that we're supporting under this program has grown from 17 in 2001 to over 700 in the 2008-2009 year. The number has recently dropped off for reasons that we're still trying to understand in consultation with the National Research Foundation. We've invested around 170 million rand in grants in this group of students/staff members. And we have financed more than 3,000 students, of which the significant majority were black and female beneficiaries. This is just a quick graph of the number of grant holders, the total number of grant holders over these years, and the number of new grant holders in each of the years. And you can see that there was a very healthy growth up until 2008, and since then the numbers have decreased. I don't know what they were in the last year, but we're busy discussing this situation with the National Research Foundation. This is one of the flagship programs. These are the demographics of the program, as I already indicated earlier on. They're fairly satisfactory in the context of the demographics of the university employees. These are some of the envisaged revisions of the Tutuka program. We need to fine-tune the Tutuka program at the moment, the type of support that the Tutuka program provides to staff members who are still enrolled for a PhD is the same as the support provided to those who have finished a PhD, and it's the same for staff members who have already finished a PhD 2 or 3 years previously. We need to fine-tune this program so we have different types of support for these different categories of new researchers within the university sector. I've already spoken a bit about postdoctoral research support. These were some of the numbers I presented earlier on. On the established researchers, human capital development really, of course, established researchers no longer need human capital development, but established researchers are a very important, are the key input into human capital development. It's the established researchers who train the master students and who train the doctoral students. So that's why a focus on the established researchers is important in this respect. We need to focus on improving the excellence and the concentration of our research efforts. So we need to focus on perhaps more strategically defined areas of research to some extent. Three major initiatives, which I've already spoken about, the Centers of Excellence and the South African Research Chairs Initiative, and lastly, the Funding for Rated Researchers, which is a program the National Research Foundation and the former Foundation for Research Development ran very efficiently and effectively in the 90s. The funding for it then decreased, and they're busy ramping this program up again now. The centers of excellence are physical or virtual centers of research. They concentrate existing capacity and resources. So at the center of the center of excellence is one of our universities, and associated with it are a range of universities and science councils, and sometimes even industrial companies are part of such a network center of excellence. They enable collaboration across disciplines and collaboration across institutions, as I've just indicated. They work on long-term projects, and they do locally relevant and internationally competitive research. This is an overview of the Center of Excellence program. Members have had some overviews of this previously. We now have 8 centers of excellence. We invest roughly 80 to 90 million in these in any 1 year. We do envisage expanding this number by about 6 in the next year or two. The themes of these centers of excellence are relevant to socioeconomic development issues. So there's one on biomedical tuberculosis research. There's another one called the South African Center for Epidemiological Modeling and Analysis. There's one on strong materials. There's one on climate change and earth system science. So they're related to strategic priorities. This is a graph of the output that these centers have been producing. You'll see that the number of master's and doctoral students has been growing in the last 6 or 7 years, the number of students that they graduate through the centers of excellence. This is a graph that indicates some of the other outputs in terms of postgraduate students and female students, black students, number of peer-reviewed publications. And this is another output from those centers, which indicates the growth in the external income that they generate. So we are funding them as seed funding, and they're intended to raise funds from other sources apart from the National Research Foundation. This program was reviewed in 2010, and the review found that they performed exceptionally well in all their key performance areas. They were effectively managed. There was a reliable flow of funds through these centers of excellence, and they were successful in leveraging external funds. And the intention, our intention, is to extend the DST support. Originally, they were supported for 5 years plus 5 years. We've now agreed to support them for another 5 years. On the research chairs, you have heard quite a lot about it, so let me perhaps just very briefly say that this is an intervention of the Department of Science and Technology, which has funded the establishment of several new, in fact, I think it's at the moment about 152 new research positions in the university sector, funded by the Department of Science and Technology. There we go, 154, there's 152 that have already been awarded. Two of these chairs will still be awarded in the next few months. These will be the first bilaterally funded research chairs. The minister made reference to this in her budget vote speech. These chairs will be co-funded together with Switzerland. They are supported at the level of 2.5 to 1.5 million rand per year, and these research chairs are very efficient also in terms of producing honors, masters, and doctoral students. What we've got on this graph, honorable members, is in the two shorter bars here, we have the number, in this case, the number of honors students per grant holder, per researcher who has a grant from the National Research Foundation to support a student. The average per grant holder is 0.3 honors students. The average number per rated grant holder, that's a rated researcher, is a little bit lower than that. But the average number of honors students per research chair, you can see, is considerably higher, four times higher than the number of honors students associated with an average researcher or even a rated researcher in 2008, 2009, and 2010. So these research chairs, at least with regard to honors students, are very efficient. They supervise a high number of honors students. The same is true of master's students. This graph represents the same comparison for master's students, although the difference is a little bit smaller than it is in the other cases, but you can still see that the research chair holders comparatively supervise much larger numbers of master's students. The same is true for the doctoral students and for the postdoctoral students. So the investments made in these research chairs lead to very effective supervision of honors, masters, and doctoral and postdoctoral students. This is a graph just outlining the research output from the research chairs by comparison to other researchers in the system. And what you see in this slide here is that of the 8,000, nearly 9,000 papers, or let's take this number here, of the 9,500, roughly 9,500 papers published by South African researchers, 416 of those were published by South African research shareholders. That's 4.5% of those papers were published by South African research authors. The number of authors who contributed, the number of South African authors in total who contributed to those 9,500 papers is 5,000. So there's 5,000 authors all in all, including those research shareholders, that contributed to those papers that were published, that scientific output. Of the number of research chairs in this year was 78. The number of research chairs in this year was 78, which constitutes 1.5% of that number. You can see that number is 1/3 of that number. In other words, research chairs contribute three times as much to our scientific output as does the average South African researcher who publishes a paper. In terms of policy development, just very briefly, some of the key strategic foci that we have to take into account. We have to encourage a new generation of researchers. We need to support more postgraduate students and postdoctoral fellows. This is a key point that I've been trying to make. In order to do this, we basically need more funding. We have enough students in our universities to grow our postgraduate student component. We just don't have enough money to make it happen. That's a key challenge. Developing the emerging researchers, we need to transform more new generation researchers into established researchers. So we need to pull postgraduate students through into academic and research careers within the national system, and we need to maximize the output of the established researchers. They are already very effective and efficient in what they do, but we need to increase the number of active researchers and supervisors in the system. We need to increase the proportion of enrolled students that receive bursary support. It's a point I've made previously. We need to ensure that the bursary values encourage full-time study, so the per capita values that we provide to students have to be increased. We need to drive the demographics and consider the unique circumstances of women students with children, particularly because our postgraduate student cohort is on average above 30 years old. Women students by that time often have family responsibilities that make it very difficult for them to engage in postgraduate studies, and we need to factor this into the support mechanisms and instruments that we develop for our postgraduate student cohort. And we need to ensure bursary values are aligned with national priorities and growth needs of scarce and critical knowledge domains. For the emerging researchers, we need to increase the number of postdoc fellows. I've already mentioned that previously. We need to strengthen the program to increase PhD level qualifications of staff in higher education institutions and in the science councils. Establish a dedicated program to fund research support for young employed researchers with less than 7 years of post-PhD experience, and seek international support. For established researchers, increasing the productivity of supported researchers, for example, by providing them more postdoctoral fellows who can help them manage their research programs and produce more research output. We need to increase the number of supported researchers. Again, that's a financial question. We need to increase the average value of research grants. The average value of research grants in South Africa is very low, and it's frankly very problematic. For a researcher in a field of biotechnology, for example, who's got a grant of 50,000 rand, there's very little you can do in biotechnology with 50,000 rand per annum. So this is a big constraint, and we need to attract and retain internationally competitive researchers. And the South African Research Chairs Initiative is a key intervention in this regard. Lastly, here are some of the legislative, policy, and strategic initiatives that we're currently undertaking. We're in the process now of finalizing a human capital development strategy, and I'm certain that the Minister will, in the next couple of months, release the strategy for broader public consultation and for consultation also with the honourable members of the committee. We have developed together with the National Research Foundation a very precise financial model that allows us to model the bursary costs. Some of the information I presented to you here came out of that model. It allows us now to start engaging with the National Treasury on an informed and empirical basis to say if we want to improve our footprint in the postgraduate student cohort, if we want to have a really big impact there, this is what it would cost. And so we can start discussing with the National Research, with the Treasury, the affordability of ramping up the per capita values of the bursaries and the number of students that we support. The implementation of the bursary policy, we've previously spoken to honourable members about guidelines that we have formulated for the National Research Foundation to use when they allocate bursaries to students. These are guidelines that will promote the demographic representativity of the postgraduate students of the postgraduate students cohort. We're drafting a science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Innovation promotion and engagement strategy. So a strategy to promote these key areas of science, technology, innovation, mathematics, and innovation within the broader public and amongst the school-going population. We're in the process of analyzing the Ministerial Task Team review report on the science and technology landscape. There's a lot of suggestions and observations in there around human capital development. And the Minister, I think, will be briefing the Honourable Members in early June, I think, on this, if I understand correctly. And as a consequence of that, of course, we're also considering a review of the NRF Act to give effect to some of these strategic imperatives that have emerged in the last couple of years, and that will be highlighted now in the Department's response to the Ministerial Review Task Team. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Acting Chair and Members. I'm sorry that it took so long, but it was a lot of information that we felt was necessary to impart to the Honourable Members. I would like to now hand over to my colleague, Dr. Matutu, who will make a presentation to you on the second part, which has to do with the engagement that we have with schools and with the internships.
Whilst you are exchanging chairs, can I suggest to members that we'll allow her to make a hope to make this presentation, hoping that it won't take long. Then immediately after that, we'll have just 5 minutes comfort break, and then we go into questions. Is it fine? Thank you, Honourable Members.
Chair, I would like to just get some clarity. How much time do we have?
If it was, if I would give that order, I would say 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
But I will, if you can,
no,
if,
that's
can
fine.
If you can manage. I'm not trying to be.
No, that would be.
That would be okay.
Yes,
okay.
That will be okay. Thank you very much.
How to move the
speaker? Okay. Most of what I'm going to be presenting to you, honourable members, has been presented by the SASTA last week. The only difference is that we're looking at a higher level or an overview as the department, whereas they were drilling into the details. So from our part, we'll just give you an overview of what we do in this section. The work here emanates from the Youth into Science Strategy, which was approved by Cabinet in 2007, and the three bullets which follow there are the thrust of that strategy, which is promotion of STEM literacy, awareness and engagement, identifying talent and potential, and nurturing that talent. And then we have, because of our bilateral with the Department of Basic Education, they've requested us to somehow assist them in enhancing classroom performance. So what we see there is the additional work that they've requested us to do. And then last, we look at the interns and the graduates which are supporting the implementation of the Youth into Science strategy. I've already mentioned the strategy and its strategic objectives, which are the promotion of STEM literacy and engagement, and also talent and potential identification and nurturing. Looking at this section of our work, honorable members, as the department, we spend about 63 million in this work in the year 2013. So this is to give you an idea of the kind of budget that we have for this work that is consistent budget, which will not be fluctuating year on year. However, what you were given last week by Dr. Damons was including the fluctuations depending on what people are asking them to do. So here we're forced to use that money on the science and youth initiatives. And the way in which we have divided the budget, we've divided it among the key thrusts of the science and youth into science strategy. So on the thrust of STEM awareness and engagement, we do have campaigns that we conduct. We have the National Science Week. I have presented to this committee, I think about two years ago, the work that we do in that direction. So since 2005, we have managed to reach 1.3 million. We're talking about interactive contact with those people rather than just the media. However, if we include the media, then the number grows significantly, and the majority of which were the learners. The National Science Week was under review. The review report is out, and it is quite encouraging to find out that the majority of the objectives that the National Science Week is trying to achieve were really achieved over the 10-year period. So it is proving to be quite a successful initiative in achieving some of the areas. And then we do support the science festivals, which occur countrywide, and the biggest being the SciFest, which is in Grahamstown. Dr. Damont also mentioned this, and I've engaged with the people who are organizing the SciFest, and they say they would gladly coordinate the invitation of the honorable members to attend the SciFest. So that is the biggest in Grahamstown, with about 70,000 people attending per annum. And then we do have the awareness booklets, career awareness booklets, which we have been circulating, which are of good quality, which we've been circulating year on year. And on top of that, we have role models who attend these festivals and so on. That assists in career awareness as well. Now, apart from the campaigns we know that they last for a week or a few days. Permanently, the permanent structures that we utilize are the science centers. So that means that on a daily basis, they are open for the learners, for the general public to come in, view what is there, interact with the people, and be able to engage more on scientific activities. So we are supporting these science centers. Normally, they are owned by the private sector, the universities, the NGOs, etc. All that we are doing is to support them. They are already in existence. The staff members are not paid by us. However, we do support them in terms of their programs. We do have the annual development grants, which we call the programmatic support, depending on the needs of the particular science center. And we have the capacity building program where the science center staff would be trained. Mostly that kind of training occurs internationally. We've had partnerships with universities in Australia. We have partnerships with science centers in France, where some of the staff members from our local science centers, including Lesotho, have had to participate in those programs. As for the annual development grants, we have decided that instead of just offering the science centers the programs, programmatic support, we need to guide them in all aspects of managing the science centers. So there will be a booklet which is providing proper guidance on how to move from one level to the next. It's more for improving performance there. Last week, honorable members, there was interest in what we do in terms of promotion of the IKS. So I felt it necessary this week to just give members an opportunity to see some of the activities that were involved in. IKS information becomes part of the initiatives that I've already mentioned. However, it goes beyond that. There are annual IKS expos and the workshops which go with those expos where the local communities would display whatever they need to display, but we work through the provincial governments, be it in agriculture, be it in economic development, be it in education in order to be able to coordinate the IKF expos. We have been continuing as the department on these expos together with the workshops. We do have the policy booklets. Those are distributed in all the activities in general. And also they use our science centers and the IKS documentation centers to distribute whatever material that they do. We have also the spring lectures where mainly the academics, though, would come together who are involved in IKS work together with the postgraduate students and the general public. We organize that. And we do have some protocols which have been established internationally. So it becomes important for us to train the communities in those protocols. For instance, when there is particular IP or intellectual property information that has been discovered for a particular community, it's very difficult for communities to organize themselves. So this natural justice biocultural protocol enables communities to organize themselves into certain entities, and we then provide workshops to assist the communities in so doing. We do engage with communities on bioprospecting more for nutritional values and also for medicinal purposes. Also in the SADC region, there are biennial conferences. So this is just to demonstrate, honorable members, that there's a lot that we are doing in promoting awareness. We have not touched on human capital development. We have not touched on the actual research. This is just promotion and awareness. Then moving on, back into the youth into science strategy. If you've got the kind of resources that we have, it's very important that you become selective in your activities. And the youth into science strategy says that you have done your awareness, you've done your promotion. It's very critical that you choose the best student and you make sure that you nurture those students. And you choose the best student in the demographics that you feel you need to promote as government, which is precisely what we do. So what we do is that we support the organizations which run the science, technology, engineering, mathematics, innovation, Olympiads, and competitions. We don't fully fund them. However, we provide whatever support. If they need anything, be it promotion, we do that. If they need a little bit of funding here and there, if they need to be coordinated, we assist with that. The science ones run through the National Research Foundation. Our science centers, service centers, how much time do I have? Okay. Our science centers assist in that regard. So the identification of talent becomes a very critical issue. We use mainly Olympiads and competitions in that regard. Now, if one looks at the Olympiads, you can see that the number of the participants have been growing year on year. You don't just ask learners to go and write a test on Olympiads. Firstly, you train them, and that training goes on through either schools or through science centers. And we have broadened our approach to such an extent that all the 500 Dinaledi schools are participating in the Science Olympiads because of the support that we provide as the Department of Science and Technology. So that gives us a broader pool to draw from in terms of the nurturing. In the past, we've ran some camps to ensure that we nurture the talent that has been identified through the science the Olympiads, the semi-Olympiads and competitions. And after some time, we realized that we needed to focus. We were working with some organization which ended up capturing all our students more for accounting, the Tutuka camps, which meant that SciCare ended up with most of our students rather than science, engineering, and technology. Now, we've partnered with Wits University. This is a program which is highly promoted by the principal of the university. We have 100 students in grade 10 another 100 in grade 11, another 100 in grade 12. I was with Professor Nonga over the weekend, and what he's saying is that he would like to see this program spread throughout the country, because to have it at VETS alone does not assist. We have to now bus all the learners from all provinces to VETS University, because we've selected them from all the Dinaledi schools, from all the communities that we're dealing with. So the camps, they are held at the campus 1 week, for 2 weeks during the vacation, and they are meant to enhance curriculum, content knowledge, and also equip learners with the necessary skills to be able to handle university education. We also do support the Dinaledi schools, the 18 Dinaledi schools, as I have previously mentioned. And that form of support, it comes as supplementary tuition, training of teachers in areas which are considered to be difficult. And some of the schools were provided with interactive whiteboards. These whiteboards enable them to work in the computer while the students can be able to see what is going on the board, and the whole lecture can be printed afterwards for the students. The teachers are trained before this IT instrument is introduced. It helps a lot in saving time. Some required apparatus for their laboratories and so on. That was provided. And in addition to what we provide for the Dinaledi schools, which is additional supplementary tuition and educator training and some instruments, we do ensure that they participate in everything that I've mentioned before, whether it's the National Science Week, their schools become centers for the National Science Week. So all other schools, they come to their schools for the national, so we provide the grants, we ensure that we provide the program and so on and so on. So it's additional issues which are there. And then in addition to that, we do support education through our science centers. At least 7 of the science centers will have laboratories. We train teachers in those laboratories. Some of the learners come to those laboratories. We've provided about 10 mobile labs in addition to the stationary laboratories, and those mobile laboratories go to the learners. Then this section of the presentation deals with the internship program. We've got a program which is run by the presidency, which is called the National Youth Service. The National Youth Service, it's an old program there where they are taking unemployed people, they are making them to be volunteers. In our case, we focused just on graduate, unemployed science, engineering, and technology graduate, diplomates or graduates. And what we do is to deploy them in science centers, in other institutions which are assisting us with the implementation of the Youth into Science strategy. So on top of that, we've got our own internship program within the department, which doesn't have anything to do per se with the Youth into Science strategy. However, it assists us to capture the human capacity which has been produced in the system, so that there is no wastage in the process of people sitting at home doing nothing while we are claiming that we need them to participate within the national system of innovation. So the work readiness programs that we run, there are many in the department. They don't all reside within our section. It responds to government priorities, skills development, reduction of unemployment, providing decent work. And the objectives are quite simple, just to ensure that we are efficient in the production and the utilizing of the skills that we have. What we have there, honorable members, are the two groups, the internship program that we run for our unemployed graduates in general, and then the National Youth Service, which is mainly to service the youth into science strategy. So the numbers, as you can see, have been growing year on year. On the internship program, we have additional funding of about 120 million from the National Treasury over the next 3 years to beef up the internship program. And the host institutions for the two programs have been growing from 21 up to 55 institutions. They include the private sector. They include this is the private sector alone, together with the science councils. Yes, that's the internships, excluding the science centers, where we're talking about 80 additional host institutions. So those have been growing, more of the private sector is on board there. So we're talking about the internship program alone. And then at the end of the internship, what we've observed is that the blue percentage is the percentage of those students which get absorbed within the institutions that they've been working for, and then the others, they go for further study. So the efficiency is astounding in this program. If one looks at the fact that you start with a group of unemployed graduates, at the end of it, about 70% is either going on for further studies or has got employment. So that is very useful. And the other thing is that the follow-through afterwards makes it difficult for us to know if more of them actually get absorbed at a later stage or not. In summary, the policy position of the department regarding this section, as it has been mentioned to the honorable members, the development of the STEM engagement and promotion strategy is key among our intentions. The strengthening of the science centers as infrastructure for STEM promotion is another area that we are going to be focusing on, and the adoption of a 5-year implementation strategy for the National Science Week, which will be informed by the 10-year review recommendations. And of course, at a later stage, the expansion of the SASTA mandate to ensure that it takes care of all the STEM engagement and promotion strategy. Thank you very much, honorable members.
Thank you very much, Dr. Matuki. Strictly five minutes comfort break. Then we are going to take questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you members. Can there be order? We are now going to take questions. We will take questions. I don't know what. I am not going to be restrictive in whatever particular order. As long as members will then be able to manage that in terms of the presentation, so that we don't repeat what the problem of having a lengthy presentation. People end up repeating themselves. Repeating what somebody else has asked, we will have to manage that, so that when they respond, they all respond at the same time together. We don't have a time for the first presenter and a time for the second presenter. So I just want to make honourable members to be aware. So it's over to you, members. Honorable Nongonyana, Honorable Plagi, in that particular order.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members, and thank you, the representative from the Department, for the report. Mine is just briefly, Chair, I think it's only one. I don't know, you have referred to Grahamstown University. You also referred to that. In my mind, I may be wrong, the universities that are not from disadvantaged areas. Yet, I think we've made the point, the portfolio committee, I think the department also appreciates it, in my view, of actually also opening up for the rural, the disadvantaged communities. And if then, can I have comfort, because I also, I think Dr. Matutu, she indicated to what Professor Norma said, who's coming from the university I come from as well, Fort Hare. And we were concerned to pass them in, these people from all over to this. We suggest in my mind, perhaps, that there's no strategy, there's no plan for these other areas. Hence, Vitz is under pressure, and hence Professor Nong clearly coming from the disadvantaged community is concerned about this and would like then to really accommodate the students in this specialized field of science. So I would therefore be pleased, Chair, if then I hear comment from them around the strategy to open up, especially for the disadvantaged areas. That is the question I have.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you for the presentation. I think it's quite a mouthful. Mine is only on page 7. I think you mentioned it, or you answered it partly, of the reasons for the drop out of the female students. What are the reasons? And then the other one is, how do you determine the values of this budget, the budget values, when doing the allocations, how do you determine the values? Which student do I give the high or the lower value? Yeah, and also on the second part of the presentation, I think I also support the notion of the passing in of some student, because we can spoke about the deep rural, but there are the smaller and deep rurals that really are not being accommodated, and we think we know them when we do our constituency work. We go to some areas that really don't understand when you talk about science and technology. What is this that you are talking about? Yeah, if those can also be reached at one instant, one will be happy. Thank you.
Honorable. On page 3, or the third slide, you refer to the Denaledi School. Now, we were informed, I think last week also, that you focus on only 18 Denaledi schools. How did you identify these schools? And is it only 18 because of a budget constraint? And also, I would like to know how successful these schools are. Page 5, just a short remark regarding output 5, human capital for growing knowledge economy. I mentioned in my budget speech the importance of curriculum development, and I know now you've mentioned on another slide that it's not part of your mandate. Do you feel it's a shortcoming that it's not part of the mandate? Because I don't think it's too far-fetched to expect this department to become more involved in the basics of the curriculum development. I would like to have your views on that. Then on pages 5, 7, 8, and 9, they are actually connected. On page 7, you referred to, and if you look at that that table in the last column, why the huge drop in the doctorates, the number enrolled as opposed to the number of graduates? It's only 10% that eventually then qualify. On this slide also, you referred to the second, number 8, on page 8, 46% enrolled never complete a degree. It's, in other words, connects with the previous one. What is important for me to ask you is, do you want or expect students to continue after a honours to a master's to a doctorate at all costs? I think the value of getting experience in that specific field is also very important. The maturity of students, that is to me very important, and I would like to have your views on that as well. Then also on page 9, how do you then plan to improve this deterioration or dropout or whatever of PhD students? On page 10, you referred to training the younger researchers, but what about, we know we've got an aging cohort at our universities. How do you just accept it, or are there plans to, for instance, raise the retirement age of these people with all the experience? On page 12, you referred to Tutuka. I would like to have some more information. Is there a booklet for perhaps on Tutuka? I think it's a very important initiative. Then, let me just see. On your 17th, page 17, you said to make bursaries competitive, they should actually triple in number. Do you then agree that one should not support this budget? It's a very difficult question to ask, but do you agree we don't have enough money in this budget for this department, and should we then support the budget? Page
20 on...
Okay, let's leave that one, page 24.
Yes, you refer to the funding period of 6 years. Why only 6 years? I would like to have, how do you calculate it? And what then if a student does not complete his or her studies in 6 years? And how does it affect the funding of the student? And then the last question is... I need some more clarity on your term related researchers. Thank you.
Thank you, Shane. I don't know whether I'll be repeating the same question, but I want to be clear or to be satisfied. I've got one question which was partly asked by previous speakers. What I'm worried about, I want to know how can we improve science performance, or how can learners be helped to improve their science performance in rural areas? Because as far as I know, they are not exposed, but they are interested in science career, but how can they also be included in this performance so that they can continue with science up to this pH.
Are you done?
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
okay.
I just got some so that you also just have a few comments and questions. I don't know whether some of us have got expectations, or is it also after a presentation our responsibility to go and check? I'm raising that on the first presentation. You know, this thing of saying too few university staff qualifies to lead the research, and then one, remember that we're playing oversight. Now, if you say too few, you're general. Is it impossible, or should we make a follow-up to check with you which are these universities? Remember that some of us are residing in provinces where we've got more than one university. An example, I'm in the Eastern Cape. That's a comment. You are too general. Secondly, a second comment, we have always... specifically myself, I've always been requesting that when you give us the statistics on either females or black, please categorize them. Blacks, knowing very well that we are all saying we are all blacks, but you know that we've got colors, we've got Indians, Asians. You know, because again, is that when we are visiting these universities, we really want to see the demographics of this, and even the class reflections on them, whether they're coming from poor areas, whether they're coming from rural areas, or whether they're coming from rich areas and whatever. I think I'm covered by Honorable Ndlazi. In your science weeks and in whatever you do of science, and I asked this question before, and the response was, I'm not quite sure which entity was, but the response was, no, there are students from rural areas, but when you look into the students, you are able to see that majority of them are coming from the Model C schools. If you say, if you are going to say, for argument's sake, if one is going to say, no, there are students, there are learners from King William's staff, I will have a problem because I know they will be coming from day high school. I'm making an example. Whereas there are high schools, there are students in deep, deep rural areas. How do you, is it your responsibility or is it the responsibility of the Department of Basic Education to identify schools that are to go to science wings? And be open and to ask so that when we sit with basic education, we're able to take them to task. Why this, not those? Because it is true, students in the deep rural areas are not exposed to these things. And it's not because of their own making, and therefore it's department like yourself that are to make those endeavors, both with basic education, to ensure that those students are exposed. Because it means that science will forever be a subject of those that have, and the have not, unfortunately, will not be. The last one is on. You said you on the youth, you work with NGOs and private. But how do you evaluate or monitor, as the Department of Science and Technology, those NGOs, the product that they are exposing the youth into science? If then that is a product that you are comfortable, and the monitoring of that, is it your responsibility, or is it the responsibility of the youth structures that is to do that? The last one is the Naledi School. We are aware that you provide support, because the Naledi Schools is a project of basic education. As the Department of Science and Technology, you are providing the support. But in you providing the support, are you satisfied with the outcomes? And if you are not satisfied with the outcomes, have you interacted with the basic education? Because we are of the understanding that it is the Department of Basic Education that then identifies schools. As I'm saying, you are giving the support, and I hope I'm correct, you are giving the support. But in you giving that support, are you satisfied with the product of the with the level of the empowerment of educators and the product thereof? Because it's quite a challenge, the issue of the denied schools. I don't think there's any member here that can stand up confidently and say, in my area, I have seen ABCD. For some of us, we don't even, we know where they are, but they are quite, it's not for you, I know it's for the Department of Basic Education, but for me, the fundamental question is that, are you satisfied and comfortable with the outcomes in terms of the support that you provide to those denied schools? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Acting Chair and Honorable Members, for the interest that you've shown in this topic and the questions that you've provided. If, with your permission, Acting Chair, I would like to ask my colleague, Dr. Matutu, to answer some of the specific questions, because she's closer to some of these programs and closer to the operational details of some of the programs to be able to provide more detailed responses to the series of questions. But allow me to start off, Honorable Members, with some specific responses and one general comment. The purpose of the very first slide, and this is a response to several of the comments or questions that you've posed. The purpose of that first slide, of illustrating the different spheres of responsibility, third slide, the one called Human Capital Development Landscape Institutional Context. The purpose of this slide, Honorable Members, was to place the functions of the Department of Science and Technology in the context, not just in the legislative context, but also in the context of the resources and the reach that the Department of Science and Technology has into the school system, primary and secondary school system, and the university system. And what I had hoped that that slide will illustrate is that our interface with the school system is very, very, very slim. We just don't have the resources, and we don't have the institutions to make an impact on the school system. On the school system, we have a relationship with certain schools, and we have a relationship through the National Science Centers, the system of science centers, with students and schoolgoers and teachers. But those are our only institutional platforms for any engagement, and the extent of their impact on the system of those institutions is very small, because it's very small by comparison to the size of the challenge. My colleague will speak to your question, Honorable Acting Chair, specifically about the Dinaledi schools, and I think the Honorable Nonkonyana also asked about this, and you did as well. So Dr. Matutu will talk to this. But it's important to explain the context. So from an institutional and from a resource point of view, we actually have no footprint in the school sector, and we have a very, very small footprint in the university sector. Secondly, from the point of view of our legislative mandate and the core competence of the Department of Science and Technology, we're not a department that is focused on pedagogic development. We're not a department that's focused on the development of teaching as an activity or as a profession. What we are in where we can support the development of teaching and the development of schools is through the development of appropriate educational technologies. Technologies that can improve the quality and the effectiveness and efficiency of teaching engagements. And we can pilot and demonstrate the application of those technologies. And in part, that is what we do in the Dinaledi schools. So that's different from developing teachers, and it's different from improving the actual teaching activity. We can support it, but we don't own it. And more importantly, we have no contact with the vast majority of the schools where improvements in teaching have to take place. So it's very important, Honorable Chair, as important as the problem of or the challenge of improving our schooling system in South Africa and the process of teaching, as important as it is, it's an engagement that the department really has a very limited responsibility for and opportunity to improve. To some extent, Honorable Klopas Lawrence, this is also in part a response to your question on the teacher development and on the question of curriculum development. Those are no doubt very important topics, but the resource and legislative resources of the department are very limited in this respect. We certainly, and the Minister made this, I think she made this response or made this point during a budget vote, we certainly do support curriculum development research through grants that through the National Research Foundation that are given at universities to education researchers. The HSRC undertakes a lot of research in this area of education development, of teacher training, of curriculum development, and so on. I don't know the exact details, but they have a program in this area as well. So in that way, we do provide support, but it's by providing support to the activities rather than owning the activity of curriculum development. So those were some of the more high-level contextual responses I thought I should just quickly give. Honorable Nonkonyana, my colleague will speak to your concerns and also those of Honorable Plaiki about the extent to which the historically black universities and the historically disadvantaged, in particular rural universities, feature in our programs, and I can assure you that there is a strong strategic focus on developing these as well. I'm just trying to see. Okay, then the Honorable Klopas Lawrence asked several questions about the drop-off in doctoral students, for example. Well, like most political and socioeconomic developments, it's seldom the result of just one factor, one particular thing that gives rise to an observation. In this case, the observation of a drop-off in the number of students. It's a range of things, and that's why we use the word attrition. There's a big attrition. Part of the reason certainly has to do with the availability of funds for postgraduate students. They simply cannot afford to enroll for postgraduate bursaries because the extended families that they have to support, the expectations of the investments that those families made in that education, those investments are being repaid by that person going out and entering into a job, because most of our graduates are first-time graduates. Their families don't have a history of graduation, of professional skills development. So there are demands on these fresh graduates at a first degree, at an honors degree, or a master's degree level. There are financial demands that they cannot meet if they're going to be a full-time postgraduate student at the same time. Then for women, there are the particular challenges that face women who, even if they're highly motivated, decide to enroll for an honors or a master's degree. Things happen in their life, and when those things happen, it's more difficult for women to persist in their studies than it is often for men. It's an unfortunate social fact, and we're trying to do something about it, but it still is there. So the attrition can be ascribed to a whole range of combination of things. We have identified the need to do some qualitative studies on our postgraduate students to understand, and our recent graduates to understand more precisely, what is it that determines that they're not going to be pursuing their postgraduate studies? What would need to change for them to have decided to do it? We have planned to do that sort of qualitative assessment during the coming year. You asked several questions, Honorable Kloppers Lawrence, along those lines. I think I've spoken sufficiently about what gives rise to the problem. You have some questions about how do we intend to tackle it. Well, one of the key interventions, as I indicated, is the we simply have to increase the number of bursaries and the values of the bursaries. There's absolutely no doubt in our mind that that has to happen. If we're supporting an average of 8.5%, 8% or 9% of all the postgrad students in the country, that means that there are 90% or more of students that receive no state support through the National Research Foundation for their studies. It's simply not sustainable in a country at this level of development for the state not to be investing in the development of its postgraduate students at a higher level than it currently is. So this is the strategic argument that we are needing to develop. There are, in addition to this gross intervention in the system, there are, of course, a range of more specific things that we've done. For example, the South African Research Chairs Initiative is an attempt to create space for senior researchers to spend time on students. When we give a research chair to a university, there is a requirement that that research chair is freed of all administrative functions except those relating to his research activities. So the university can't get him to sit on a whole lot of committees and deal with budgets and all that kind of stuff. Also, their teaching is limited. They are, for example, not supposed to be teaching to undergraduates, large numbers of undergraduates, when they have to mark 1,000 first-year chemistry papers at the end of the year and mark tutorials and so on. So there are interventions that we make like this in order to free up researchers so they can spend more time on their research activities and their students. So there are a range of interventions like that that we're also making at the level of the programs of the National Research Foundation that are meant to address this problem of how can we promote the more efficient enrollment of doctoral students so that we don't have 10% of them only graduating in any one year. The other part is also that the average time taken for a PhD student to graduate is about 4.5 years. So in any one year, you would in any event only have a 25% in a steady system. If you have 1,000 students enrolled at PhDs, you'd only have 250 of them graduating in any one year. So that's part of the statistical observation that you have made, Honorable Member, as well. I've spoken to the Honorable Ndlazi's concern about improving the learning experiences of students in the rural environment. environments. The answer, in short part, is that we simply don't have the institutional mechanisms and the resources to be able to intervene there. And secondly, it's not part of our mandate. However, through our engagement with the Dinaledi schools, the National Science Week, and the outreach activities of the science centers, which our colleague from the National Research Foundation, Beverly DeMont, I think, may have spoken about last week, through those, we are trying to make an impact and demonstrate how broader impact could be achieved if the resources and the institutions were developed in order to do that. And we think that we are showing how these things can be improved, Honorable Dunjwa. So I think in part, and Dr. Matutu will give you a more specific answer on your question, are we satisfied about our experience with the Dinaledi schools? Remember, our engagement with the Dinaledi schools is in order to demonstrate the application of educational technologies, technological interventions in improving the experience and process of learning and of teaching. And in that respect, my understanding is that the interventions that have been piloted there in the form of technological support for the teaching and learning process, I think that there's some very positive experiences that are being developed there. Then you made an observation, Honorable Acting Chair, about us being a bit too general when we talk about that there are too few PhD level staff at universities. And you were asking us to explain that in a little more detail. You are right, there is of course a big variation. In some universities, on average, they have 60% of staff, or 65% even, of staff with PhDs. But then the other side of the coin is that some only have as many as 15 or 20% of their staff with PhDs. Now, we do not have, as a department, relationships with individual universities that would enable us to make institutional interventions in those individual institutions. Those institutions are governed by councils that are appointed by the Minister of Higher Education and Training. And so we, by force of our work as a national department, we work at the level of the system. And we have to use system-level indicators, just like the Department of Water Affairs. It has to say, okay, on average, 95% of South Africa's population has access to a water tap. But that does not mean that every community has 95% access. It means there are some that don't have, and we still need to deal with that. But that department deals with that. So in as much as there are some universities that only have 15 to 20% of PhDs with staff, that's a problem the university needs to understand and needs to address with the support of the Department of Higher Education and Training, with our support as well through the Tutuka program that my colleague Dr. Matutu will be talking about a little bit more. So we are addressing this even at the institutional level, but through a program, Honorable Acting Chair, that applies across the system. But that is targeted, as I said, at promoting the number of black, African, colored, and Indian students and staff members in pursuit of PhD degrees, and of women. And we are very clear about the importance of this, not only for moral and ethical reasons, but also because it's simply, you know, if I can use the comparison, imagine Australia building its science system on the basis of its minorities, which are in that case, it's the Aboriginal minority. You know, the Aboriginal population comprises maybe 5% or 8% or 10%, I don't know, of Australia. There's no way you can envisage this Australian science system being built on the minorities. It's just not a sustainable demography. In the same way, we understand as the promoters and supporters of the national science system, we cannot build the future of South African science on the basis of South African minorities. It's just not demographically feasible. Leaving aside the question whether it's right or wrong, it just doesn't make any sense. So we understand the strategic imperative and the moral and ethical imperative of this, and it's factored into to all of our programs. I apologize that in some cases we did not break up the statistics. We'll take note of that, Honorable Chair. In some cases you will have seen that we did, but certainly I agree that we can provide you more information in this regard. I think I've addressed more or less directly all of the high-level questions and those relating to my part of the presentation, and I'd like to now hand over to Dr. Matutu for some of her responses.
To know your input on a question regarding people getting experience in the work,
yes,
world of work, as opposed to going,
yes,
head on.
Thank you. May I answer that? Thank you. I think, Chair. Yes, Honourable Clovis Lawrence, that is an important question, and my answer will be informed again by my observation that we're dealing with system-level statistics. So you're absolutely right. An individual student whose number appears in the column for honors or masters or PhD students, the fact that there are numbers in all three of those columns doesn't mean that an individual student should be moving through those qualifications, honors, masters, and PhD, without taking any breaks, without going and working somewhere else for a while. So absolutely, it is particularly in the areas of engineering and physical sciences, where there are applications in economic development, in engineering companies, particularly there's significant value to be added in the training and development of that person at the high level for them to do a first degree, maybe an honors degree or a BTEC, a four-year degree, and then go and spend some time working in their professional environment and then going back and doing a master's or a PhD, maybe even while they're still working. So there's significant educational and training value in that, and that, of course, as you will probably know, is the fundamental pedagogic model for many of the University of Technology academic programs, the BTEC programs and the MTEC, Bachelor of Technology and the Master of Technology programs. The idea is that the students enroll for these degrees, for these formal academic qualifications, and they do work in industry at the same time. So certainly, those interruptions are of significant value, and those statistics are not meant to deny that value.
Dr. Matu, thank you very much, Chair. We've had quite a number of questions from honorable members. I will combine some of the responses. The first one is about the reach of our program and to what extent we are able to reach the former black universities. We don't have that category of former black universities anymore. However, I will try to look at our rural universities, which are five currently, University of Venda, University of Forte, University of Zululand, Walter Sisulu University, and the University of Limpopo. So out of the five universities, in four we have science centers. So we're able to use this science center, as I've already indicated, to be able to advance the science awareness and engagement and to be able to participate in STEM Olympiads and competitions. The only program where they are not participating is this one of nurturing talent. However, the students are coming from all these areas because they've been identified using an instrument which is being utilized in all these areas. It may be VETS, which is doing the nurturing. However, the students will be coming from all over the country, as I've mentioned. To establish nurturing or talent nurturing programs within the universities, it's not an easy thing because it means that you have to get academics and educators who are well established to be there during the vacation, ensure that the institution participates in all aspects, it's open, residences, this, everything is operating. So what we did was more to piggyback on an existing successful program
we don't have only the students that we have. Central is supporting students there at Rift University. BP is supporting students there. So students which are being nurtured in this program are more than ours. However, we're only supporting 300. So it's very important to mobilize the institutions which have got capacity to do so during the vacation to be able to do that kind of work. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom because the students are coming from all over the countries with the areas, demographic, rural areas being represented through these universities that I've just mentioned. On the issue of science centers and our oversight on the science centers, as I mentioned, honorable members, we provide the programmatic support for science centers, and they're able to report to us what is going on, their progress annually, and we have reached a stage where we have realized that they are at different levels of development. So we've created an instrument, or we're in the process of creating an instrument, where we are saying that if you are at this level, then what will it take for you as a science center to move up to this level? We're going to implement that through the National Research Foundation. And if you are this well-established science center, what will it take for you to mentor another science center to get to the level where you want to get? So that document has been co-authored using the managers of the science centers, and it will be implemented via the SASTA of the National Research Foundation. So it will enable us not only to just have oversight, because they are able to report to us on the particularly the usage of our grants and how it's utilized and so on, which we are comfortable with so long. But that instrument will enable us to have a holistic picture of what is going on within the science centers. And on the National Science Week, I believe that the Honorable Chair did see a few of our learners who were interviewed in a television program, and which made her to think that we are focusing more on Model C schools rather than rural schools. Honorable Chairperson, I think it will be important for us to invite you in future to our launch programs together with some of our activities. That is not the case. We've got a very big footprint when it comes to the National Science Week in very remote rural areas. People who participate, both from the launch, we do have quite a significant number of students who are there, and also in the activities throughout the week. And provinces are coming on board with their money to say that we would like to add this amount of money to ensure that our learners participate in this thing, and we've got sites where we are able to promote science. So the National Science Week is one program which we can, with a certain degree of ease, say does have a footprint nationally. The numbers may not be that big, however, it is spread out countrywide. And on the question of the Dinaledi schools, we do have a bilateral with the Department of Basic Education. As early as the last time we met was on Monday with the two deputy ministers met, Deputy Minister Anekom and Deputy Minister Seti. And in general, there is concern about the performance of the Dinaledi schools. However, when we looked at the data of our schools that we support, we realized that over the past 3 years, there has been improvement in participation for at least about 56% of those schools. However, there have been fluctuations for about 20% or so. Where there has been a decline in performance, we're looking at about 20% of those schools. And if one considers our interventions, as Professor Afdihaide has mentioned, those are supposed to just supplement what is being provided by the Department of Basic Education, which is telling me that certainly it means that there's something that is positive about it. The problem comes when it comes to mathematics and the physical sciences. The proportion of students who actually perform well there and the proportion of students who are registered for those courses or those subjects, there has been a decline in mathematics, there has been a decline in physics, which is a bit of a concern. So, and the performance, there we've just looked at performance for 1 year. We need to look at the trends over the number of years to see whether there's an increase. But the overall performance, I could say that that is not bad at all if one considers the kind of interventions that we are providing for those schools. The schools are spread out countrywide. There are two for each province that we support. It's a mixture of your former model schools and your the former black schools. So we do have that mixture within the 18 schools that we support. Trying to see if there's any other question that I have not. Yes, I've already spoken about that. Okay, then it's the Tutuka. The Tutuka program. I think regarding the Tutuka program, Dr. Maharaj can just enlighten members about that because she runs the program.
Yes, with my permission, and but I think you won't take much long because we need to wrap up.
Honorable members, the Tutuka program has been going for a number of years now, and as Dr. Afdihaide has indicated, only 35% of university staff have PhDs. And it was also put in a time where we had a lot of young researchers that were entering the universities and needed to advance their research and their qualifications. And what we found that despite our many efforts, our challenge is still in being able to identify in particular black women and African women in particular. And they're not coming through in applications from the university, so that's going to be our priority this year to focus on. We revised the program about 2 years ago, and we focus it at three levels. Firstly, there are people in the system that need to get their PhDs. We call that the PhD track. Then there are people who have their PhDs but need to establish themselves as researchers, and we call that the post-PhD track. And then we have people that have been in the system but have not been able to establish themselves as researchers, perhaps because of family duties or they've been in an environment where they could not establish themselves, and we support them. Now, prior to revising this program, the numbers had grown. And while we had large numbers of women, they were 70% white women, so we revised the program and set ourselves targets which are perhaps very ambitious. We're targeting 50 to 60% women and 80% black grant holders. But we're finding that the applications that come from the university are still about 50-60% only black, so that's something we will work with the universities with. As we increase the number of grants with the available budget that we had, we found that we were giving smaller and smaller amounts of money to more and more people, and they couldn't do much with it. So the program became more competitive as it became more successful, and we certainly could do with increasing the budget substantially so that we can fund more people. We do have documentation that we've prepared mainly targeting people that want to apply for these grants in the form of a framework document, an application guide, and a pocket guide. We have a small little pocket guide, but we could put together information that speaks to this program and make it available to the committee.
No, thank you very much. I hope we will be invited in the next science week. We'll be interested in attending. They are very much interesting activities that are taking place. There's one that fascinated me up to now, the issue of organic mathematicians that was done in KZN, the women that are doing bid work, something that was said that I don't think any of us have ever thought that in fact what they are doing, multiplication, subtraction, or the angles and the sign, the mathematicians will know about. So I'm saying those are the things that are very much interesting in some of us, because it's a process of really demystifying science and technology, that in fact what people are doing every day of their lives, it's maths, it's science, it's only that it has been taken away from their eyes. If we had time, I will elaborate why I say it has been taken away from their eyes. So those are the more political and ideological issues around science and technology. But thank you very much. I do think that it has been quite an interesting presentation, and they will look forward in the invitation for the next science week. I'm sure that will be. We're going to sort for the launch. I must make a formal request to the department that it must go to Port Elizabeth the next time. Thank you very much.
But we're coming from Fonte, Honorable Chair, you remember? That's very rural. What more are we looking for?
You are delaying us.